Welcome to episode 34 of Justice with John Carpe, the podcast from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. I'm the show's producer, Kevin Steele, and our guest today is Lisa Bildy, a lawyer with the center based out of London, Ontario. Today, we're talking about the pandemic lockdowns and their impact on seniors in long-term care homes in Ontario. Since the beginning of the pandemic, our most vulnerable citizens, those in long-term care, have suffered the most and suffered the most deaths from the COVID virus. They've had harsh restrictions imposed on them, and they live under something like house arrest, with no visitors to protect them from the virus's further spread. Unfortunately, though well-intended, these restrictions on visitors have kept their loved ones away, and some of those relatives, those loved ones, had been providing additional care and acting as advocates for their mothers, fathers, grandparents, aunts and uncles, sometimes interceding on their behalf with medical and administrative staff. With that additional care, advocacy, and oversight taken away, it can be asserted with little dispute that in addition to causing emotional and psychological damage, the government lockdown measures have been causing physical harm as well. They have eased up somewhat over the last little while, but the little the government has done appears to have caused more confusion. The Justice Center has highlighted this issue for a while. Now action has been taken. Recently, papers have been filed with the court. Lisa, can you bring us up to date on what is happening with this issue?
Sure. Well, it's been a little bit of a long time coming. We have finally managed to get our application together and out the door. It's not an easy case. It's actually quite complicated for various reasons, which we can get into. But so we filed the application with the Divisional Court. It's for a judicial review. But what we have to do now is we have to wait for the court to make an assessment of whether it's sufficiently urgent. This is another one of our new normal things that we have to deal with post-COVID, which is our courts have a gatekeeping function now with new applications. They largely shut down, as you may be aware, after the pandemic was declared, and they have really been kind of slow at getting back up to speed. To their credit, they've put a lot of new technology in place that probably is 20 years in the making. We should probably have had a lot of these things in place before. So that's the good side. So, for example, we now have the capacity to do online hearings. We can do assignment courts where we choose dates for hearings. We can do that by phone rather than now having 30 lawyers sitting in a courtroom wasting time waiting for their turn to be called. So there's lots of good things about that, but one of the holdovers is that we still can't file new applications without establishing first that they are urgent. So we have prepared the documents and we have sent them to the courthouse, the divisional court, but we are now waiting for a triage judge to assess whether it's of a sufficiently urgent nature that it should get a hearing while we're still in sort of a shutdown mode.
Okay. In the Justice Center press release, they refer to it in the first line as a potential lawsuit in divisional court. Is that why
that
it's
is
a potential?
Why. Yeah, that is okay. Why. I mean, it's ready to go. And normally, in pre-COVID times, we would just go down to the courthouse or send it with a process server. They go up to the counter and have it issued automatically. Nobody would look at it beforehand. Every application would proceed and you could get it issued and then served. And then, if it turned out to not have any merit, then there's ways of dealing with it down the line. But certainly no judge would review it ahead of time to make sure it was an okay case before you could get it issued. So, that's a little troubling, to be perfectly honest. I think that it does impede access to justice. And I'm surprised it's still going on for 5 months. But we'll get the endorsement from the judge shortly, and then it won't be prospective anymore. We'll get it served in the government. We'll move forward.
Oh, okay. So at least I understand why it's potential at this point. Mm-hmm. In a previous podcast where I was discussing this with one of your colleagues, he noted that one of the hurdles was that people would come forward very upset and, ready to proceed with some kind of lawsuit against the government, but then they would back off. Obviously, here we have, I think it's two, isn't it? Two applicants that you're working on behalf of. And they're, of course.
That's right.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, that is an issue, and not without some good reason. I mean, I think a lot of people have been worried. You know, they wanted to tell their story to us. And if you recall, we've been talking about this for a few months when we opened up our website to allow people to tell their lockdown hardship stories. And there were many, many of them. What we noticed, of course, was that long-term care stories became quickly the very, the number one kind of concern that we were hearing about. And that was back in the spring already. We sent our first demand letter to the Ontario government in June, alerting them to some of these concerns, a more specific demand letter in July, and now proceedings in August. But what worries, I think, a lot of families is that if they sue, and especially if they were to sue a long-term care home, that there could be some retribution to their family member. Mm-hmm. And maybe there wouldn't be, and I would like to think people wouldn't behave that way, but it's not an unreasonable concern to have, especially when you're not able to get in there and monitor and make sure things are okay. So now we are not suing individual long-term care homes. We're just going after the government.
Right.
And I can explain why that is as we go forward here. But it was hard to get people who wanted to come aboard. There were a number of people that I wrote to and said, okay, I want to do this. Can you let me know if you're willing to sign a retainer? And then from those, I kind of went through and I looked for cases that seemed to be the most compelling. And again, the way we're going to do this is in a way that hopefully will benefit everybody and not just the families who are on the application. So it wasn't quite as critical to have, 100 families coming forward agreeing to do this. I think in the end, just the fact that we have a couple, the focus will be on the government's behavior and not so much on the individuals who are bringing the application forward.
Right. Well, the reason I brought that up actually is because I actually wanted to circle back to the issue of urgency and the fact that we have a couple of people that are willing to go on the record with these concerns, not necessarily their concerns, but those concerns out there in the public, the fact that people are stepping forward. Seems to me that the issue is getting a little urgent. And looking at the facts of these cases, they seem fairly urgent. We're talking about people in their mid to late 80s here, aren't we?
Yes, mid 80s. I think one's 84 and one's 85.
Okay, right. Yeah. So obviously they're suffering with a couple of comorbidities.
Yes, Alzheimer's. And they're deteriorating quickly too.
Right.
So that's the issue. I mean, people in long-term care generally don't have a lot of time. It's not their friend. So, 6 months or a year might be all you have for many people once you move in. So yes, it is certainly urgent. Now, some long-term care homes are beginning to allow a little bit of access, and the one family has had some access, but it is not what it was in the sense that, family caregivers before the COVID crisis would be able to have 24-hour a day access. They would be able to just go into the home and be with their loved ones whenever. And there's a residence bill of rights that says that the residents can have visitors whenever they want. I mean, that's not to be restricted because this is their home. I mean, they're not in the hospital. This is their home. And so there haven't been restrictions up until this pandemic. And now they were completely locked out. Now some homes are starting to give a little bit of access, but again, it's being doled out as they see fit and not with the freedom that it used to be in place. And it can be withdrawn and curtailed at any time. So,
right.
So and then the other applicant still cannot get in for regular visits with her mother. She's been doing window visits and has had a couple of opportunities to get in to the home when her mom has had a crisis, but just very, very briefly and certainly not regular. So one of the reasons for going after the government rather than individual long-term care homes is because the government could issue an order that applies to every home and, stops making this such an inconsistency across the province, which is very frustrating to families too. And they can see that some other family is getting access to their loved one, but they're not. And the circumstances are really the same.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Just to back up a second there onto that patient bill of rights, where is that from? Is that a Ontario government thing? Patient's bill of rights?
It's actually right in the legislation. The Long-Term Care Homes Act in Ontario has incorporated something called a residence bill of rights. And so it lays out a long list of rights that people have. And it's important to recognize that just because you are elderly and maybe you're not as capable as you used to be of looking after your own affairs, it doesn't mean that you've checked all your, you know, your rights at the door. You're not a prisoner. You're somebody who, you know, just needs extra care to get through your day. And so probably as a result of previous problems with long-term care, this Bill of Rights was incorporated right into the legislation.
Okay. Well,
now it's being disregarded at the moment.
Well, that's what that was where I was going to go to next, because in speaking with Bruce Parody last week on this podcast, one of the maxims that I'm pretty sure you're familiar of, because you were actually cited as somebody who had helped him, was that there is no right without redress or opportunity for redress. So I was just going to ask about that Bill of Rights. It's being ignored. Is there no redress? Because I noticed in this lawsuit, primarily cited is the Canadian Charter. Mm-hmm. And is there no redress in that Bill of Rights? In other words, is it just sort of paper tiger?
Well, because of the crisis situation that we're in, or alleged to be in, 5 months, 5+ months down the road, that I think is a question mark. But, the rights are being suspended all over the place and even under the Charter. So, there is redress, but it's subject to this balancing act, similarly to what the Charter requires. As to whether, I think you could call your ombudsperson or the Ministry of Long-Term Care if those rights were being violated, but they aren't going to be of any help right now, because they've all concluded that because we're in this pandemic, whatever restrictions anybody wants to put in place are acceptable. That seems to be the case, because I know a lot of families have called the ministry and complained and have called their ombudsman and they're not getting anywhere. If they can even get a live person to actually speak to them, they're not getting the answer that they want. So you're right. I mean, they are kind of paper tigers. I guess they are in theory the rights, but if you can't enforce them, they aren't much good.
Okay. All right. So now let's go to the Canadian Charter that you are using in this lawsuit. This is the Section 7, isn't it? The mm-hmm. Okay. And that was supposed to get you talking. Mm-hmm. Section 7 is...
Sorry. Yeah. I thought you were going to give me a little lesson about it.
No.
Yes, that's the right to life, liberty, and security of the person.
Right,
and.
Yeah.
And which is not supposed to be violated or infringed by the government except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. So, there's a couple of considerations in whether that section applies. The government doesn't have to proactively provide you with things, but it's a negative right. It should keep the government from infringing those things except in accordance with principles of fundamental justice. And then there's the Section 1 consideration as well, the balancing act of whether an infringement is justified in a free and democratic society. So there's a couple of steps to the analysis. But I don't think it's too much of a stretch to think that if you're putting people in solitary confinement, in effect, in their homes, that you are infringing those fundamental freedoms. I do think mm-hmm. that the government is going to have it's going to have some trouble justifying it, even with the pandemic, in light of the fact that the weight of authority is starting to lean towards letting the caregivers back in, and the consequences to these folks is turning out to be as horrific as the COVID in the first place.
Sorry, weight of authority? What is that?
Yes. So, we're not the first people to come out and say this is wrong. There have been a number of experts, people who are active in frontline care and are professionals in geriatrics and nursing and that sort of thing, who've come out and specifically focused on the elderly and have come out with several reports now. I've seen at least four. I'm sure there are more. I've relied on four in our demand letter, which state that essential caregivers, family caregivers, are really must be introduced right away. Get back in the homes. They are critical to the care of the residents. They're not just visitors. They're not just casual people who, visit once a month. These are people who actually, this is an important distinction to make so that your listeners know too. We're not talking about just anybody wandering into the care homes. We're talking about people who provided 10 or 20 or 50 or even 100 hours of care prior to the lockdown. So the one applicant, I mean, that sounds like a lot of hours, and it is, but they actually hired some private caregivers to supplement when the daughter couldn't be there. So between the private caregivers and the daughter, they were providing 15 hours a day. That works out to 105 a week of hands-on care. So the lack of that care has consequences. I mean, they weren't just sitting there chatting with them. They were providing physical comfort care, personal grooming, bathing, toileting, helping with feeding, and making sure that their anxiety was in check, helping them with memory exercises, doing physiotherapy, interceding with the staff. You know, there's just a long list of things that people would do for their relatives. And without them there, most of those things aren't happening. And so the experts that I was referring to, including the Registered Nursing Association of Ontario, the National Institute on Aging, various others, have come out with reports just imploring the government to let them back in, because the effects on the elderly are just dramatic and horrible as a result of this isolation and the lack of care. So,
right.
Yeah.
Maybe we can get a little bit into the specifics of the plaintiffs here, I guess. Is that what they would be called?
Applicants in this case.
Applicants, sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Have you had an opportunity to meet with any of them personally, or has this simply been a remote thing due to the pandemic so far?
It's been remote. So I haven't had a chance to meet with them, although it turns out that the husband of one of them I knew a long time ago, but that was just a coincidence. So I haven't seen him for 25 years. We've been communicating mostly by email, but the one sent us a story early on for our website, and she's been quite, this is Susan Mills, and her mom, Barbara, is in a home in Arnprior, Ontario, which is up near Ottawa. And so she, her mom had, has dementia, advanced dementia, and had broken her hip. And so she was in a wheelchair. And so Susan had been helping with physiotherapy and trying to get her mom mobile again. But all of that stopped with the lockdown. And so she's been diligently going to the home every day and having these window visits. And it's been quite a poignant story, such that it's been picked up by the media many, many times. Susan's been a very vocal spokesperson for getting caregivers back in, because her story is just so, you know, it's compelling, and she's been willing to put herself out there and let people know what's going on. So she had sent us something, was on our list of potential contacts, and was willing to come forward as an applicant. And she's the one that has still not had much access to her mom. And the home has said, look, there's going to be no physiotherapy. They don't have the staff. They're not bringing enough people in. So her mom's been sitting in this wheelchair, deteriorating. She's lost the will to live sometimes. Susan has said she's been trying to cajole her mom into just kind of hanging in there, because, you know, she's, especially with patients with dementia or residents with dementia, they need to have that access with their family in order to kind of keep a connection to their old lives, right? And they're being severed. So.
Oh yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about there. I just, full disclosure, I'm actually looking after a patient at home, my mother, who is suffering dementia and cancer, and throughout this, and so I found these stories particularly compelling. You know, even the introduction of masks on the care workers caused confusion, and still causes ongoing confusion. So I can imagine, you know, what it's like being separated from your relatives by a window. That would probably be completely disorienting. The other lady, she's the Italian woman.
Yes, she is. Yeah. And so she had had a couple of strokes last year. Mm-hmm. And in addition to dementia, which was progressing, her daughter was, though they were very, very close, and her daughter was attending all the time to help her, and worked diligently in trying to get her some recovery after her stroke. So she was actually starting to use her limbs again that had been rendered useless, I guess, by the stroke. Was quite effective with that, actually. But one of the issues that she's had is that her mom, because of the dementia, doesn't always remember that she has physical limitations. And so she tries to get up to walk, and right. she will fall. Now, when she had 15-hour-a-days a day care, she was being watched and protected from that. Somebody would put her to bed at night, and then they would know that she'd, you know, be safe till morning when somebody else could come back. So she is a fall risk, and in fact, since the lockdown has had at least a couple of falls that our client knows about. I'm sure there, you know, there's a lot of things she doesn't know about, but you know, there was at least, there was one where she had cut her face and broken her glasses a bit, and it's very hard for the families to see these sorts of things happen and know that they're preventable, but that there aren't enough staff, and I'm sure that. Most of these families would say that the staff that are there are trying to do their very best with the circumstances that they're under and they're dealing with. But they were grossly understaffed before, which is why families have been such an integral part of the healthcare team. They fill those gaps that are not able to be met by because of staffing shortages. And so, and they also provide oversight into these homes so that and maybe that's one of the reasons why they're not. Where they're the last to be let back in, they do keep an eye on things.
Right, yeah, and they are willing to speak to the public. That brings up another issue I wanted to revisit for a second, and that was the introduction of the military as a supplement in a few homes. The two homes that we're dealing with here in this case, neither of those were subject to the introduction of military, were they?
No, there were, I believe, seven homes in Ontario that were in such bad shape after the lockdown that the premier called in the military to help with just getting things under control. Partly the staff, because there was an outbreak, some of the staff weren't coming in. People were being left unattended. It was quite a horrific story, actually. But I think most homes aren't quite in that bad a shape. Mm. But these ones in particular had severe problems, and the military seemed to be the solution that the premier adopted anyway. And then a few weeks after that, he announced that they were going to offer the opportunity to teachers on secondment to go into homes and help. Now, this is kind of galling to the families as well, because you see, they know very well how to look after their particular resident, and oftentimes would provide assistance to other residents too. And got to know the other residents. So here you're allowing in members of the military and teachers and other new hires and trainees and part-timers and whatever you can get in there to try and fill the staffing gap. But they've left out the family caregivers for some reason, treating them as some disease vector while allowing all these other folks to come into the home. And, you know, if you can contain the virus with respect to those people, why can't you do the same things with the family caregivers and let them back in too?
Well, that's very logical, too logical, I guess, for this situation. Right. You did say for some reason, and that's why that was just before I was thinking of interrupting and saying, what is the reason? Do we have a justification for why they're doing that, inviting in teachers, the military, but not letting family members in?
Really, no. I mean, all they're saying, well, first of all, one of the reasons that we're bringing the application in the way that we are is as against the government is because they've taken the responsibility to send out directives, which are binding orders, essentially, on long-term care homes. The chief medical officer of health issued a directive right after the outbreak was declared and basically shut the door told long-term care homes to shut the door to all visitors, which they did. And then the next directive, the same directive, but another version of it, was called Directive Number 3. And there were actually seven different iterations of it throughout from March through to June when the last one was issued. And they've just been so inconsistent and lacking in clarity. And the definition of who an essential visitor is has been changed multiple times. For a period in April and May, it actually included family caregivers, and then that was taken out again. And so during that period, the premier and other officials during press conferences blamed the long-term care homes for not letting family in. Then they switched gears at some point without any explanation that I've heard as to why the change in tune, So that they're now telling people who are asking, when are you going to let the families back in? They're saying, well, you know, we're just concerned about the risk. The premier said just the other day, we're being maybe a little too risk averse, but, you know, we just don't want to take any chances. These people are vulnerable. And so they've essentially admitted that they are the ones now keeping essential families out of the definition of essential visitor. And in the latest iteration of the directive, that they took that, took them out completely and came up with some new category of, so let me just explain those definitions a little bit, because okay, I think that's important. What they said in the original directive was everybody has to stay out except essential visitors. Essential visitors can even come in during outbreaks. And those are the people that are needed to do things like, come in and prepare food or deliver, health services like doctors and, the definition, as I say, kept changing and adding and subtracting things, but they had kept for large parts of this period family caregivers out of that definition. So they had a category for visitors, and then they had these essential visitors, and only essential visitors were getting in, and family was just kind of left out of the equation. For the most part. Again, it's all very confusing and conflicting. And part of the problem is that their own lack of clarity in these orders has meant that the long-term care homes have just said, forget it, we're keeping everybody out in most cases.
I see. Just as a way of dealing with it. So that everybody can be on the same page. Okay.
And I'm sure they're concerned about liability too. I mean, that's really, it's a big part of it. You know, they've already been sued multiple times by other firms. There was a class action that was started recently, at least one. I'm not even on top of how many there are, but based on the handling of, there's long-term problems with long-term care, long-standing problems, which are the subject of, constant review. And, they're always doing inquiries about what's gone badly with long-term care. So some of these things relate to long-standing problems, but there's at least one, maybe two that I'm aware of, lawsuits for damages, like monetary damages arising out of their handling of the COVID crisis in long-term care. So they're basically saying, you guys screwed up and all these people died. Well, maybe so, but that doesn't help our situation, because we're saying, well, okay, they handled it badly, but we know better now. Yes, people did die in those early days, and yes, for various reasons. Maybe they were letting people come back from hospital when they still were contagious, or they weren't taking people to the hospital. They were keeping them in long-term care homes when they were contagious. They didn't have proper screening protocols in place, or they didn't have enough personal protective equipment in place for people. That will be for those lawsuits to figure out what they did wrong. But now, and certainly over the last few months, as things have gotten under control, and we do have a lot of personal protective equipment, and we better understand the virus, and we can screen it better, and we have tests in place. There are lots of ways that the reintroduction of family caregivers can be done safely. But I think that the government is still in the mindset, and long-term care homes for that matter, of, this is just increasing our liability by letting more people in. That's more people who can infect our residents. But they're so laser focused on this one problem that they aren't recognizing that their solution, keeping out all these people, is actually a problem in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And a problem which has repercussions, which we may find in the end are more deadly to the elderly over the long term than the virus. Assuming that you're not letting it run rampant, the risks of the isolation and the lack of care and malnutrition and other consequences of not having enough care are going to be a lot more damaging for these folks is our concern. So. So it was kind of a long-winded way around here, your question, but yeah, so we've decided to go after the government in judicial review for the decision that they took it upon themselves to issue these directives, and they could easily have fixed the directive. And when they were blaming the long-term care homes for keeping people out during April and May, when the definition sort of did include them, it was really unreasonable of them. They could have made an order then to tell the long-term care homes to let them in. They could have made all these things clear. And in their final directive in June, they made things even muddier by coming up with some whole new definition, which they didn't actually define, a new category, I should say, of essential caregivers. So they had visitors, and they had essential visitors, and then they had essential caregivers. But they didn't define it, and they didn't actually tell the long-term care homes what to do with that category of people. So essentially, you know, we could all probably assume that that meant family caregivers, as distinct from casual visitors and as distinct from the maintenance people or the cooks who come in as essential visitors. But they didn't tell the long-term care homes what to do with that group. So it's their own lack of clarity and their own failure to put forward a directive that is intelligible and reasonable. That is why we're going down this judicial review path and going after the government. They could fix this problem with the stroke of a pen, and they have not done so.
Right. So I guess that goes to redress here. What are we seeking, or what are you seeking here? Is that what you were seeking in terms of what the purpose is? You simply want clarity, or do you want the managerial state cleared out the way completely? I mean, exactly are we going for?
I'm looking to solve the immediate problem, which is to get essential family caregivers back into the homes. That's the goal here. And to get a declaration that the elderly residents' charter rights are being violated. So we're asking for declaratory relief of the government, because we want to establish that should there be a second wave or a future situation, that you can't do this to people, that it's contrary to their fundamental rights, and a declaration would help with that for going forward, and would also give some redress, even though it's not financial. It's an acknowledgement that these people have been wronged, and I think they want to know that. And we're also asking for the court to, it's called a mandamus application. So it's mandating or forcing the government to fix the problem, to make the decision the way they should have made the decision, in an intelligible, reasonable manner. Again, it's, the rule of law says if you're going to have laws, they need to be clear, and they need to be equitably enforced or equally enforced. And they can't be just this kind of hodgepodge of inconsistencies that people are supposed to figure out for themselves. And then, so that's part of the goal, is to get them to issue a clear directive. And they're not doing it themselves. They've been asked by the families, they've been asked by the experts, they've been asked by lawyers, and they've refused to do so. So it would appear that a court application is the only way to go. There is, by the way, an MPP, an NDP MPP, who has brought forward a motion to get the caregivers back in too. And it did get a reading and a bit of a discussion in the legislature, but then I don't know what happened with it. So I don't think it's on the table for any serious consideration. And what we have found through this post-COVID period is that, you can draw all the attention you want to the problem. It isn't until there's a lawsuit threatened or started that the government actually responds. Mm. And as you may recall, with the church cases that we've had, first there was the drive-in church services case that we launched in Ontario. Within a few days after starting that application, the order was changed to allow for drive-in services. Even though the government knew about this, it had been going on for weeks. There had been showdowns in the parking lot between police and the churchgoers. that it certainly had been addressed at the cabinet table, but nothing changed until the application was brought in court. Right. And then we launched, if you recall, a few days later when I was approached by someone from the Orthodox Jewish community to say, hey, that doesn't help us because we can't sit in our vehicles on the Sabbath. And we don't have access to mechanical items. We can't use mechanical things on the Sabbath. And we can't meet in our group of 10 for prayer because the restrictions at that time said you can only gather in groups of 5 for religious rites and services. So when we put out a news release on that issue, it was within a matter of days as well that we had a meeting with the government and were able to resolve that one without even going to court. So I was kind of hoping that would happen here too, without having to go to court. I mean, I don't have any problem with going to court, but it would obviously be a faster result if we could have just got the government to the table, but they didn't seem to bite. So Now, they have to respond to a court application. They don't have to respond to pleas from family members and to emails and to tweets, but they do have to respond to a court proceeding. So that's what's going to force them to the table now.
Maybe, and because it has to go through this initial adjudication period, though, too, right?
And well, that's true. That's true.
That's a bit of the drawback. I was wondering, as you were speaking about the admission of on the part of the government, which is declaratory or something like this, I was, do they increase their liability by admitting that they did wrong here? Is that part of their holdup? Like, you know, could these people that you are representing here who want redress and simply, you know, trying to get the government to move, I'm not saying that they would, but other people in this circumstance, could they say, okay, now we can proceed to getting the money for this? In other words, could they up the ante on these people if the government admitted wrong or went the direction that you are urging them in? That's what I'm just trying to gauge, whether they are, you know, in the back rooms talking about potential liability by admitting wrong here.
Well, I'm sure that they are always conscious of that. But I honestly think that if they solve this problem the way we're suggesting, they will decrease their liability. The longer this goes on, the more consequences there are going to be that they potentially face actual lawsuits for damages over. And so, you know, in our demand letter a month ago, I pointed out that it was in their interest to get these caregivers back into the homes. It helps with the oversight of these places. I mean, the government, you know, isn't necessarily hands-on in these places. They inspect them and they license them, but they're not in there every day, looking at how things are operating. Families can go in and do that and help nip problems in the bud. Right. And problems that can become the government's problem later. And so, in my estimation, they would do better to get these families back in, get them providing the care, make sure they're doing so safely, and you can put those rules in place. But, I mean, we're managing to get all sorts of other sectors of society up and running with no consequence. The numbers are still very low, and I realize that the elderly are more vulnerable, but even there, the numbers are very, very good right now. And we just know so much more. I don't think we should be judging what we do today on how things went back in March, because we didn't know much about the situation. Or, you know, arguably, and I'm sure the lawyers running the lawsuits against them will say, well, they did know and they didn't act quickly enough. But I mean, we are in a different place now here in August, and we were in July and June and May too, for that matter, where we could have done these things. But, you know, I give them a little bit of leeway over figuring things out in March, in terms of wanting to kind of close up shop and get a handle on things, especially where there were outbreaks. But as soon as you get get a better understanding of the virus and get the equipment that you need for people to gear up to go into the home, I don't think there's really any more reason to be holding back. There's no reason why they couldn't give them the same protocols and the same protective equipment that they give to the staff.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, they're or teachers or whoever else they want, or military people that they want to send in that aren't necessarily medically trained. Okay.
Right.
One of the things I wanted to get to here was something based on Jay Cameron's statements regarding how difficult this actually is for people like you personally having to deal with this. The lawyers, he said, this is a very difficult topic for them, and, you know, they're taking it quite personally. Is this taking a bit of a toll on you dealing with this stuff? Because it is, you know, it's the harshest stuff of the pandemic, as far as I'm concerned, dealing with the vulnerable and the people who have been impacted the most, both with the lockdowns and the deaths as well. Mm-hmm. How are you holding up throughout this?
Well, I'm holding up fine. I'm able to, I don't have a loved one in long-term care right now. So I'm not sort of feeling that on a personal level, although we have had, of course, relatives in long-term care who are gone now, and I know that if they were, that I'm sure I would be feeling a lot more personally torn up about all of this. So I'm compassionate, but I'm able to maintain my professional kind of objectivity about everything. I am concerned about obviously how the longer these things go on, the impact, not just in long-term care, although I think that's one of the most egregious examples, but in so many other ways too. I mean, I've been saying this since March, that the consequences of the lockdown are going to be so much more harmful in the end if we're not careful about this. And I still strongly feel that way. And I think, sadly, unfortunately, much of that is being proven. You know, you've gone over lots of the stories, I'm sure, with John when he's been on your show. And, you know, I don't need to run through a litany of the examples, but, well, I will tell you one that's sort of come to my attention as a result of doing long-term care. It's not just the elderly who are impacted. There are actually kids in congregate care settings who haven't been able to hug their parents for 5 months. You know,
these are the ones that we haven't been talking about. Yes. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so this particular application, I mean, I'm focusing on long-term care in part because honestly, Kevin, where it is difficult is the fact that we're a small group and we're nationwide and there aren't enough lawyers doing this kind of work. This is the kind of case that you would throw a team at. I'm here by myself in Ontario trying to do this. And you know, I'm always up to the challenge and we will do it, but broadening the application too much would make it just like you just start getting into all sorts of evidence, gathering evidence and turning it into a monumental task. It's already a big case and a difficult one to wrestle. So I didn't pursue the other congregate care settings at this time, but I'm hopeful that if we can get the government to budge on this, logically, the same directives would apply to all the congregate care settings, but that would include the homes, group homes where children and disabled young adults and so on live. So it isn't just the elderly, but it is other vulnerable people are being impacted, and some of those stories are really sad too. There's a mom I've been in contact with she's also been fairly vocal in the media, and she's actually taken the matter to the Human Rights Tribunal. But her boy is 14 and has a number of developmental disabilities, I guess, and so he comes home from time to time, but hasn't been able to since the lockdown. And he's in a group home that I think only has like two kids, and the staff can hug her child, but she can't. She can't hug her own child, and I just that one kind of gets to me as a mom. To think that you've put your child in this care because you can't physically look after them 24 hours a day. So they would take her, I think she takes her child on weekends and he goes to school during the day with his brother. I may not have all the facts quite right, but they were certainly very active as a family in his care, but now have not been able to be. And it's heartbreaking to see that. And he communicates in ways that you really need to have physical touch. So without that, they can go and see him from a distance with masks on, but they can't touch, and he can't communicate with his parents in the way that he does, which is by grabbing their arm or, you know, taking them somewhere, or, you know, it's not allowed. So
that sounds, well, pretty heartbreaking. And it's something that we haven't really discussed before, I guess, because you haven't taken it up. But you think that if you approach this one and properly and you win, it will impact like group homes and things like that as well? Is that so this will cover the directives that you're seeking will cover those?
It doesn't technically. No, it covers because this directive is only to long-term care homes. But the reasoning is the same. And if we can, and I'll certainly be raising it if we get into any sort of discussions with the government about what needs to happen. But I don't see why the solution couldn't be the same. And so my sense of it, Kevin, is that the government is largely stuck at the moment in a lot of ways with these lockdowns. All the governments are. It's very hard for them having absolutely frightened the populace into the situation that we're in. They're having a hard time pulling back out of it again, and they need a push. And so maybe if they get a push in this case, then that will be all they need to move in some of these other areas as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by push you mean lawsuits, which is okay, fair enough. Okay, well, let's get back to the charter and the rights. We were talking about the patients' rights. We were previously talking about a patient's bill of rights, and when we're talking about charter rights, I assume we're talking about the people in the care home. The people that are working with their adult parents, do they have rights as well under the charter? Is it something that they can claim?
Well, we are claiming on their behalf personally, which is novel. Primarily, we are focusing on the elderly relatives. So they are the ones who are in the home. They are the ones who are confined. They're the ones who don't have access to their substitute decision makers. And that's another point we haven't talked about, and I'll just touch on briefly. For both of these women in our application who are elderly, they are suffering from dementia. They can't make care decisions for themselves. And so they have powers of attorney that they had provided to their daughters years ago, and the daughters are acting under those. And so they are their substitute decision makers. And so any decisions about their health care and so on should be made by their daughters. But they can't get in to assess the situation, and they can't monitor medications, and things are happening without their consent and without their oversight. So that's a concern too. But, and I think that also goes to the security of the person. You know, these elderly women have made arrangements for this type of situation when they're unable to make decisions for themselves, and that's not being respected. And so as a result, they're not being cared for in the manner that they had wished. And the government's getting in the way of that. And so, you know, that's where the charter is supposed to keep the state from interfering in your personal and physical and psychological integrity. And so we're saying, well, the government is doing that. It's getting in the way here of what these people want, and the way that they're doing it is not the most proportional or minimally impairing way. You know, there are ways that we could protect the safety of the residents in the home and still allow people to have access to their substitute decision makers, their family caregivers, their loved ones. But, you know, there's a novel argument to make, and I've thrown it into the application, and I would like to pursue it. And that is to say the daughters have a very important parent-child bond. There's been some case law the other end of life, you know, when something happens to a child, or, you know, the parent-child bond there has been recognized as going to it being protected, you know, when we're talking mm-hmm. about Section 7 rights. But it hasn't been considered at the other end of life. And I, you know, my view is that those are the times in our humanity when we are closest with our parents. At the beginning when they're looking after us, and at the end when we're looking after them, because they need us in a way that is just, it's very dependent. They're very intimate. There's a very intimate connection that happens when you're starting to look. And I mean, you know this if you're looking after your mom. The relationship that you have now as a caregiver is undoubtedly a lot different than it was when you were 25 and she was whatever, 50 or 55. When you were both independent adults, it's a very different relationship now when you're having to care for her needs. True. So should the charter respect that parent-child bond at the end of life? I would say maybe it should. We don't have any law on that, though, so that's a novel argument to make. And so I am saying that the daughter's charter rights to the security of the person are being impacted as well.
Right. Without diving into the books and flipping too many pages, could you give me maybe some idea of what type of law at the beginning of life that you're referring to that we have case law on? Do you have an example?
Yeah, there was a Supreme Court of Canada case back in 1999 called New Brunswick Minister of Health versus JG. It was the parent's initials. This was where a child was removed from parental custody pursuant to the state's authority. And the court held that it was a serious interference with the psychological integrity of the parent because of the parental interest in raising and caring for a child. So there, it was held to be a gross intrusion into a private and intimate sphere. So now there's a qualifier in there because obviously the state sometimes does have to step in where, you know, the parent isn't doing their job properly, but where they're sort of usurping that parental role or, you know, causing the psychological and emotional stress from getting involved when they are not justifiably supposed to, there is some law to say that the parent has their rights are violated as well. So I guess what I'm trying to say is maybe there's a way to flip that too, because this again, there's this bond is something that is much more pronounced at the end of life too than right. it is during the middle.
There was a word in there that tripped it for me, and that was custody. I mean, custodial law. I mean, mm-hmm. do the care homes or group homes, do they have custody? I mean, we know that the parents will sign over power of attorney and things like that, you know, and medical decisions to their children. The children essentially become the custodians. I don't know if this is the proper terms or not, but I mean, who has custody over these people, the elderly?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, physically, the long-term care home is looking after their basic needs, but they are not, you know, this is not a jail, as I said at the outset. This is mm-hmm. They are residents free to largely come and go, right? I mean, that's, you know, they physically may not be able to at some points, but mm-hmm. they don't go in and the door doesn't lock behind them kind of thing. So, but where they aren't able to make decisions for themselves or they do require physical care, then, you know, it is their kids who have that authority to make decisions for them. So the role reversal is real and very comparable in a lot of ways to what mm-hmm. you see at the start of life. So it's novel, and I think it's worth raising. I think we should have an assessment of whether the state can interfere in that relationship. One of the most devastating things for all concerned during this lockdown has been people dying alone.
Right.
People don't want to die alone. People want their loved ones gathered around, and loved ones want to be gathered around. I mean, it's a passage, obviously, from life. It's not something you get a second chance at. I mean, you know, you don't get, like, so many of the things that we're all having to put on hold are inconsequential. But there are things that can't be done over, and you can't say goodbye to your loved one if you've missed the chance, right? And so that is one of the things that it has been really galling about all of this, the insensitivity towards those passages, those important milestones. And yes, we need to keep safe, but sometimes maybe safety isn't the first concern. They do let people come in sometimes and I think they're supposed to let them come in for palliative or end of life. But for a lot of families, that has meant, you know, maybe they get an hour and a half with their relative just at the very end. And for people coming who have to travel, you know, they may not get that opportunity. Maybe they wouldn't anyways, but you know, you're just not being able to get in there at the end of life and missing that, is scary for both the residents and for their family members. And I just think we've been kind of callous about that, or the government has been kind of callous about that.
Okay. Could I flip the script on you and just get your opinion here? And, mm-hmm. you know, suppose we have a hypothetical situation where we have a relative in long-term care and we know they are dying, and we are faced with this situation. So we rally the family and we say, well, that's it. You're coming out. Can they take that relative out? You're coming to die at home.
Yes, they probably can. I actually know there's one person who, I do know took her mom out. Well, she went into hospital and then she took her from there. The concern is, and see, a lot of families have been weighing this. This is a heavy concern on a lot of parts right now too, is should I take my relative out? Well, what the homes are saying is, well, take them out if you want, but you're not going to get the space back. And so that's usually been the deciding factor for a lot of families is, you know, if they're not right at end of life and you think that they're going to have to go back in when all this blows over, you don't want to necessarily take them out of the home that they do call home and maybe is the only one in their small town, for example. They'd have to go to some other town or city to find a place for them later. So that has been a consideration that has kept people, you know, keeping the relatives in long-term care when there's a big pull on their heart to bring them home where they can be kept with them. But certainly I think, you know, if you are at that end of life stage, bringing them home, maybe the best result, if that's possible to do. And it isn't always possible. Sometimes these folks are in such need of concentrated care that it's just not possible to provide it. But
Yeah, and sometimes it's just not possible for the relatives to provide mm-hmm. the care at home.
That's what I mean, yeah.
I understand, yeah. I just, what I really wanted to establish was they had the right to do it in a pandemic, do they?
Well, they should have that right. I mean, you know, we did have somebody tell us at the start of the pandemic that they couldn't get their child out, or sorry, their parent out. It was a son trying to get their relative out from a government-run facility, and they were having some trouble. And that was actually what got us doing some research on that question of whether there's some rights there for the caregiving adult child. So I'm not sure how that one ended up resolving, but I mean, I have seen other people take their relatives out. So
it can be done, but
there'll be threats and consequences for doing so, which is, well, you can't come back.
Right. Yeah. Understood. But I just wanted, it was, that kind of goes to that custodial right that I was concerned with. Cause I mean, that's what you're mm-hmm. dealing with a couple of things there when you're talking about using the examples of, early childhood and parenthood as opposed mm-hmm. to late in life. So I just want to
make sure. Right. Oh, yes. I mean, I'm sure that the government will make the argument too that it's not a perfect analogy and that yes, you can pull them, whereas you might not be able to if they were taken into care by the state, you might not have that choice but to, you know, to take them back into your own care if they've been taken away. Mm. So there is a distinction there, but there are also a lot of similarities which I think should be explored.
Right. And do you think one of the things that should be explored is maybe some clear direction on the homes? If people did, in a pandemic situation, remove a relative, could they reserve the space? You know, because, I mean, this is something, an issue I think you might want to deal with as well. I don't know. I'm not telling you your job, but mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the fact that the homes will do this, it's probably a very real concern. You take them out. We're going to fill that space with somebody else, and we're not going to throw them out once you decide you want to come back. So, I mean, could that be handled in something like a bill of rights, a patient's bill of rights? Which,
I mean, that would be beyond the scope of what we're trying to do with this particular application, I think. I mean, you know, maybe that could be part of a directive during a pandemic, you know, for the government to tell the long-term care homes that they, during this kind of a crisis, cannot threaten to foreclose on somebody's right to come back. Maybe that is worth at least mentioning. I don't know if we can get an order to that effect. I kind of doubt it. But it might be something worth lobbying for when this is all said and done. So in case it happens again, that's in the Bill of Rights going forward. And perhaps that would be up to the legislature to make sure that happens.
Well, how much of what you're seeking is pandemic specific and how much is, I guess, just generally applying, you know, in pandemic times and in regular times, the stuff that you're seeking? Is it specific to this type of situation?
It is. It is specific to the pandemic because the family caregivers have the right to go in normally without restriction. So these restrictions are as a result of the emergency legislation and residual orders that, even though we no longer have a state of emergency in Ontario, we still are stuck with all these orders and directives, which is another issue, which may need some attention in court too. If we didn't have the pandemic and so on, these people would be fully free to go back and forth and, you know, go in the homes and carry on. It's only because these directives have come out in light of the emergency that these restrictions have been put in place. So we're just trying to make sure that, because we may not be done with this for a while. I mean, given the way our politicians talk, we could be dealing with some sort of restriction on our freedoms over the next year, even. If that's the case, we'd want to make sure that we've got an order in place that's clear and reasonable and rational and, you know, allows essential caregivers to have access.
Right. So you're saying essentially, if you want to drag this out, you better get your act together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's good enough.
Yeah, and I mean, so again, it's not us making all this stuff up either. As I said, the RNAO, the Nurses Association, they had a series of 5 recommendations in their report on how to get essential family caregivers back in and do it safely. And they're very, very simple and cogent steps. And so we endorse those in our demand letter, and I'd be happy to see that followed for settling this if the government was inclined. But otherwise, you know, if they're not prepared, then we'll be hopefully going forward to a hearing and getting charter declarations and the whole works. So they can resolve it. They've had the ability to resolve it all along. And hopefully this will give them the push they need to do so.
Right. Okay. Well, great. Just before we go, do you have any idea, estimate on how long this first stage takes?
No, I really don't. You know, this is the first one I've brought in divisional court in Ontario. We have different levels here. So judicial review applications are taken to divisional court, but normal court applications are brought, like just a regular charter challenge, they're brought in the Ontario Superior Court. So I did one with the Church of God case in the Superior Court, and it was only 2 days for an endorsement to come, although the judge said he wanted to see our injunction material, so he didn't actually give a final determination on the issue. He said, well, let's see your injunction and then we'll assess. But I mean, at least I heard from the judge within 2 days. But it's been, I filed this with the court last Thursday, and today's what, Wednesday? I haven't heard anything. So I don't know. I really don't know. I'm hoping it'll be soon.
Okay. Well, people keep telling me the wheels of justice grind slowly. Maybe yes. That's normal now. We're going back to normal, I should say.
Who knows? Everything is just so uncertain, and it's very hard to give anybody counsel on what to expect. But sure. You know, I'm sure that the judges are doing their jobs and looking at things carefully, and I'm confident that, you know, somebody will address it shortly. And I don't see how you couldn't say this one was urgent or wasn't urgent, but.
Yeah, I guess we'll fair see. Enough. Well, one thing certain is we have come to the end of our time here, and I want to thank you, Lisa Bildy, with the Justice Center, for appearing on episode 34 of Justice with John Carpe. Thanks a lot, and we hope to have you back soon.
My pleasure. Thanks, Kevin.